only go so far. Or
some sort of loud verbal display challenging ET in general out in the middle of nowhere?
That's what I was doing. I actually had a pistol in hand. I was really kicked off. When I was having this fit, I was waving the gun in the air, okay, and I had this fit. And at this moment, I said, okay.
He was a Louisiana man named Montaldo. Folks around called him Six Gun Joe. Worked with ICAR, don't you know? Investigating UFOs. Out for a drive with a gal one night, they stopped to check out the reporting site. When an alien lit right there on the ground, he commenced to throw in his weight around. Now, old Six Gun didn't take too kindly to that kind of thing. So he got Vaseline or anything, but, you know, seriously. Well, Six Gun looked that critter right in the eye and said, any last wish before you die, yo? Reached for his gun, quick as a twig, and said, fill your claw, you son of a bitch. Now, a legend spread across the land about this pistol-waving man. But if you're from space or from Earth below, you don't give a Six Gun Joe.
Welcome to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of UFO Undercover. Like Natasha says, I am your host. I hope everyone's having a great morning, great afternoon, great evening, wherever you are on our beautiful blue planet. I say this every week, guys. It's my favorite thing to come do. I get to talk to 144 countries around the world, all kind of people about a whole range of topics that are running. I sigh. Sorry, guys, talking virtual autonomy. It's just one of my favorite things to do. I come here every week. I've been doing this for 10 years. I think we're on, show 500, if I remember correctly. I'll have to actually go see. We're right around there. I might actually be a little over that. So check it out. You know, the archives are free. They're located at ParanormalRadioNetwork.org or UPN.org. There's a whole host of addresses and ways to find your way to the archive site. We've also started by special request. We'll do this for a few people. I'm not going to make a habit of this every week, but once or twice a month, I'm reposting popular archives that have been requested by more than a few people, usually a dozen or more. I will go back and post the archive, repost it so it's at the top of the list again, so it's easy to find and for people to listen. So there's a few, some of my archives, some of some other people's archives. I see the show I did with the Church of Mavis Saturday is doing quite well. Brought the archive site down twice this week, which is, of course, now back up. We don't have any problems with that. But that was interesting to see. There's a lot of people going to check out that archive. On the one about Gulf Breeze has also been reposted by popular demand, which is nice to get up there. And one of the last Voice of the People done by November Hansen will be reposted this weekend. That's by demand as well. So guys, check them out. They'll be available on the archive site. They'll be up there for quite some time, so you got time to go look at them and check them out and see what's going on. Tonight's guest is going to be Lamont Woodham. I actually was just learning about the gentleman while we were talking prior to the break. I'm going to bring on in just a second and have him introduce himself and introduce the new book and tell y'all where you can find it and what we will be discussing. Now, remember, too, after the first hour, the phone lines will be open, 504-273-7379. That's directly into the Skype system, so you can log into us. If you're on my Skype list or you're one of our many friends of the Paranormal Radio Network, you can also join us on Skype and check us out that way as well. And Skype just sent us this new thing about GroupMe, so we're going to probably be adding that to what we're already doing, along with the whole host of archive stations you can find this on. The syndicated stations were on, and all of our own personal servers. So, guys, you can't say I do make it easy for y'all to listen to the show. Tonight's guest is Lambert Wood. Lambert, why don't you come on and tell everybody a little bit about yourself. Tell them a little bit about the book. Let's tease them at first. And then I want you to tell them about the story we were just talking about when we were coming on. So go ahead, man.
Okay, again, the name is Lamont Wood. I'm a writer living in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And the book is called Out of Place in Time and Space. And you can find it on Amazon or in Better Bookstore. Myself sitting beside a woman who's a museum curator. So I was asking her, is there a particular way to find a painting somewhere in Europe? That's all I know. She said, no, it's really hard, she said. And so I described the painting to her, and she nodded and went away. And then the next week she sent me email. She had found it. I intrigued her enough to that she went out and found it. So I'm not even the first person to have worked on the book, as it turned out. And the painting I was talking about, it's the one I used in Chapter 1, and it's painted in 1460, and it's hanging on the wall of a museum in France. And it's a fairly standard church painting. It shows the Madonna with the Christ child on her lap. And for centuries, it probably hung there, and no one paid much attention to it. But nowadays, our attention is kind of drawn to what the Christ child is doing, because he's depicted as playing with a pull-string toy helicopter. Now, that's pretty weird, considering it was painted in 1460. Now, people will tell you, oh, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, he sketched out a helicopter one time. He was 8 years old when this thing was painted, and he had nothing to do with it. His conception of the helicopter worked. There was no way it shows a passenger, but there was no way on it to dampen the torque, so the body would have spun one direction, and the blades would have spun another. This again, it's just a flying toy. You pull the string and this stick with the spinning blades on the top would have sprung up and flown away. But you know, that's sort of another theme I noted when I was researching the book. I have like 42 examples of these things in the book. And what I keep noticing is that children's toys are too frivolous for serious attention. And here we had a flying machine in the Middle Ages, and the fact that they're including it in this painting just means the artist says, you know, this is a toy. I have put it in the hands of this individual to show that he is a child, because the way they depicted people back then, you know, it's no way. I also discover, like, for instance, the Greeks and Romans had steam-powered toys, and it never occurred to them to use them for serious work. And of course, we've all heard the stories of the tombs in Central America or South America, where they find wheeled toys in tombs of cultures that did not themselves use a wheeled transport. So I, instead of sitting here saying, gosh, they were stupid, I think probably it'd be better to sit here and say, what are the kids doing now that we should be paying attention to? Are we still here? Right? Something happened here in the background. Hello?
Yeah, okay, I thought I lost you for a second. That was weird. Can you hear me okay, Lamont?
Yeah, I couldn't hear you. Could you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah, that was weird. Just for a second there, it was like it was a hiccup for her.
Oh, okay.
Real quiet. Okay. That was kind of strange. Yeah. No, but I was thinking when you were talking about Leonardo and helicopters, not many people realize that when they looked at the drawing, that one person was probably one of my helicopters. because they're just looking at the drone, they're not looking at anything else. They just,
right.
They say, well, it looks like a helicopter. Well, yeah, it does. Yeah. But looking like, I mean, I can go if it looks like a helicopter. I couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
Hell, I was in avionics electronics. I'm still a hard time telling you how the damn thing worked. But I'm glad I didn't mean to interrupt you guys.
Okay, but I was saying, it's a thing I keep seeing over and over again, that children's toys are apparently too frivolous for study, but they're sometimes doing amazing things out there, and maybe we should pay more attention. Like I said, Greeks and Romans had steam-powered toys, but never apparently considered using them for serious work. And of course, like I said, in Central America, we find wheeled toys in tombs of cultures that did not themselves use wheeled transport, though that's probably because they didn't have decent roads and draft animals. They didn't have horses.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, having this example, I got some other examples together and began looking for what I call a high concept to pull all this together. And the high concept, they came up with what I call the reverse anachronism. Now, a standard anachronism is like when you go to the movies, and the movie is about Rome. They're speaking English. They're not speaking Latin. But that's okay with you because you don't know Latin anyway. But that's really an anachronism because these people are portrayed with something that's out of their time. They're supposed to be Romans, but they're speaking English. Okay, but that, like I say, that's a matter of portrayal, how they're portrayed. And it's not really threatening or nothing controversial about it. My concept of reverse anachronism is that it's something from the present that we find in the past, either belief, information, practices, or an actual object in some cases. Now, if we have reverse anachronisms like that, it would stand to reason that there must be reverse anachronisms from the future that are here in the present. And presumably, they're noise and we don't understand them. And so it's hard to identify them. But there is an excellent example that showed up. I was researching a book called the Antikythera mechanism. It was this thing found in the seabed off the Greek island of Antikythera, hence the name, in 1901. And at the time, it was presumed to be just a jumble of corroded bronze gears. Are we there again? I heard something weird going on in the background. You still there?
Yeah, that was I actually had to turn that line. I thought it was somebody calling, and I just
But in 1901, they thought it was a massive corroded bronze gears. Okay, after 100 years of studying it, we now know what it is because it's now sort of like come in the sink of our present. It was an ancient Roman computer, basically. Now in the computer age, we can see that, and it's not a computer in the digital programmable sense, but the a computer where the programming is built into the design, like the old artillery fire control computers, etc. And in this case, it was a device for synchronizing or reconciling the lunar calendar with the solar calendar, which is still due nowadays. I mean, they set Easter based on the lunar calendar. Then we say, well, it's going to be April so-and-so, which is in solar calendar. So actually, we still do that. And it did some other things as well and track various planetary positions. Modern reconstruction shows it was using what they call epicyclic gears. If you have a car with an automatic transmission, there are epicyclic gears in there. And previously, they were assumed to have been invented during the Industrial Revolution. But they show up in a device it was around in Julius Caesar's lifetime that the ship it was on probably sank about 65 BC. How they could have done that, we don't know. But obviously, it represented generations of accumulated knowledge and skill. Yeah, both in the creation of the intricate geared mechanisms and in tracking planetary motion. I mean, someone didn't throw that together just for a ship sail, I guarantee.
No, we know we lost a lot of knowledge between the burning of Alexandria and a few other things that went on. Just whatever was lost in some of the other places that were completely annihilated in time and space. Right. So there's a lot, but see, ancient history to me, because, you know, I do things and I tell people all the time, you know, especially the fields we work in, you should always start in the past and work your way forward, because frankly, I find the past, there's stuff that just is out of place. I'm looking at how I'm presenting this, it just doesn't belong there, and you're thinking, okay, and I don't want to take away from man, because, you know, man's smarter than we look in a lot of areas. And we do learn things through repetition or any many ways, but then if it's you know, not kept a good record of, we lose it. And people don't realize, like today, everything now is going digital, and within 100 years, everything will be digital. If there's ever a great electronic wave or some kind of great war, we'll probably lose 90% of what we have.
Oh, it's already in danger, even without that.
Yeah.
They call it the digital dark age, because the hardware and the software both become obsolete so fast. And the files you have today, you may not be able to read them in 10 years.
That's true, because I want to know problem.
Yeah. So there's a lot of people worried about this.
Well, they should be.
But anyway, but you're in the construction business, so one of the other reverse anachronisms I discovered that would probably interest you would be cement and concrete. Officially, concrete was can be traced back to a British patent issued in 1799, and it seemed to be part and parcel of the Industrial Revolution. And the accumulation of capital that demanded large construction of the fast time frame, and so you needed concrete because you couldn't depend on quarried dimension stones, et cetera, et cetera. And that's all true. But then you go to Rome, and you find these buildings that are made out of concrete. Pretty weird, considering it was invented in 1799. The Pantheon, for instance, in the middle of Rome, is the largest freestanding concrete vaulted structure. It's I forget what you call it. It's like the, it's a big dome. It's a dome, basically. Freestanding concrete dome. And it was built about 120 AD. We're not sure why. We're not sure how they built it, obviously, out of concrete, but we don't know how they got the skill to do that. We're not sure why they built it. It's not really a temple. People refer to it as a temple, but the design of it does not allow for any, pagan Roman worship. So we really don't know why they built it. There's a sign on the front that said it was built by a certain person, but we know that the person they're referring to had been dead for about 100 years when they built it. So it just gets weirder and weirder. But you know, that's not unusual of ancient buildings. We often do not know much about them, or as much as we think we do, or we actually look into it.
Well, I always found the concrete thing interesting, because the very first time I read about it was, oh, God, 25, 28 years ago.
Yeah.
And then about 10 years after that, I seen a special not only on the concrete of Rome, but come to find out not only did Roman make concrete, but they made concrete that could harden underwater.
Absolutely.
Which was a very good step all the way across the board. And I always thought it was an interesting thing, because it was a very advanced concept for the time period that it was. They seem to do it, and they seem to use it quite a lot throughout several areas, and not just, and it was even, what, about 300 years, 500 years, somewhere up in there. Time frame where this stuff was being used, and poof, it's gone again. Until when you were talking about the British patents, and that's what 1800 years or 1000 years. And so you know, I mean, poof, it's gone, and it's back. And apparently, there's it's just a new reinvention, is what it really is.
Right,
it's just being reinvented. Which, see, those kind of things fascinating. It's like the little battery that they found in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that was for electroplating gold. Okay. Well, who in the hell figured this out? You could use electricity to electroplate gold, and how to make electricity all at the same time. I'm thinking, that's a stroke of brilliance, even by anybody's
standards. We got to remember that the modern scientific environment is a modern invention. With the publishing industry and all that, and the fact that you're supposed to come up with things and publicize them for the better good of man, that would have been considered ridiculous centuries ago. I mean, you're supposed to keep it secret to yourself and make money off it. I mean, the original, like, patent laws of the U.S. Gave you a patent for, like, 17 and a half years, of which you had a monopoly on new invention. That was the time needed to train two apprentices who would then support you in your whole. And the last thing you wanted to do was a third apprentice or somebody else to come along, because that would, of course, weaken the market value of the whole thing. And of course, there was no publishing industry before, 1445 or whatever it was when they invented the printing press. So it's what we have nowadays, it really can't be compared in many ways to the ancient world. They did come up with stuff, obviously, and I found many examples of that. But it wasn't sustained in many cases because there was no mechanism for doing so. My favorite example would be Archimedes, who you've probably heard of, as an Archimedes screw other things, and and came up with mathematical laws for the lever and a bunch of other simple machines. He was in charge of defense planning for the city-state where he lived called Syracuse, which is in the, and it still is, on the eastern coast of Sicily. And in the so-called Punic Wars in 200-something B.C., Syracuse, which was originally on the Roman side, but then they had a coup d'etat, went over to the Carthaginian side, and the Romans sent an army to take the place. And there are accounts by three different ancient historians about what happens when the Roman army attacked the city. And they all read like science fiction. But they've been sitting on the shelf now for more than 20 centuries. Obviously, this Archimedes was a mad scientist with massive financial backing, apparently. He had full government backing behind it. It was a fairly rich city-state. The Roman army, they started off a daytime attack against the wall. And they described this missile fire that tracks them all the way up to the base of the wall, which they thought was impossible. There seemed to be a minimum range. All that implies finely tuned catapults, accurate range finding, and central fire control. You usually don't see that until about 1912, that combination. So that drove them off. So they came back for a night attack, and they brought their ships up against the part of the city wall where it faced the ocean. And we're going to storm over the wall with ladders from the ships. And as they came up to the wall, they described these large machines suddenly rearing up on the other side of the wall and extending booms over the water, which either dropped rocks on the ship and shattered them, or dropped grappling hooks, which then they reeled in the ship, usually capsizing. You lift up one corner and the opposite corner goes in the water. Or actually pulled them out of the water, for that matter. And, of course, they fled, basically. Presumably he had come up with something that resembles modern construction cranes. We have the upright vertical boom and the horizontal boom, presumably using repurposed naval gear. And he did this, you know, out of thin air. He came up with this entirely on his own. I don't know what he used to power it, but presumably some kind of drop weight thing, using pre-positioned weights, etc. Like I say, the Romans panicked and fled, but regrouped and laid siege to the city and eventually starved them out. That took a couple years. And after that, Archimedes was killed when they finally overran the city. But the thing is, you see no further mention of these machines. The Romans came into possession of them, but apparently used them only for kindling or something. And we really don't know what was going on. Except for these accounts of the battle, we really don't have any description of them. Now, beyond that, there was the thing about the death rates during the same siege, which started about 212 BC. And when I say death rays, the account of that is not in the three ancient historians I previously mentioned. They show up in later sources, like in Byzantine, you know, or early Dark Ages or something. So, by people who apparently weren't basing it on first-hand accounts, but they got it from someplace, and they are consistent. And apparently, he came up with billboard-size clusters of polished metal mirrors that he used to reflect sunlight onto enemy warships and set them on fire, supposedly. Now, modern attempts to recreate this have had mixed results. I mean, and they haven't been able to, you know, ships just burst in flames or anything. And especially if you have, you know, a crew there with buckets and wet canvas and stuff, you might not accomplish much. But I was, while researching this, I was watching TV one day, and they had one of these gossip news shows about celebrities, and they're showing, I think, Jennifer Aniston having her birthday party at a resort on the southern tip of Baja California. And she was being pestered by paparazzi bobbing out in the water just beyond the surf. So the managers of the resort got a bunch of employees out there lining, each one holding a large mirror and reflecting the sunlight into the faces of the paparazzi and just driving them away. And I was thinking, you know, what if the stakes were a little higher and both sides were armed, you know? In case of Syracuse, they would want blockade runners to get in and out of the harbor, and it would be safer to do that in daylight. So maybe you could use, like, the mirrors to, like, dazzle the opposing picket boats or drive them away or something like that to give your people a head start. You wouldn't need to set them on fire to accomplish your goal. That'd be fine if you did, but it wouldn't absolutely be necessary. So maybe they need something like that. Or, for all we know, this being Archimedes, maybe they come up with lasers or something else. Or, you know, we don't know. But yeah. I think we'd find more evidence.
There's a city, and you might be able to help me, which I've been looking for a couple weeks. About 30 years ago, I had heard about this when I was in private school. It was one of the stories they talked about, Middle Eastern city. I believe it's during the Crusades, and it's one of the things. But anyway, they talk about the city has been under siege. What's so interesting about this story is both the victor and the conqueror and the loser both report this event the same way. They said that the city had been under siege for several days on a disc of Pergate. Now, they've been trying to knock this gate and wall down for probably a couple of weeks or a couple of months. I'd have to go find it. But they've been trying to get into the city without any luck at all. All of a sudden, this shield just showed up. A beam of light came out from the bottom of it and blew the gate to smithereens. And, of course, the invading army rolled into the town and killed everyone.
Right.
Mostly everyone. But I find it interesting because both report this. I found it again about 10 years ago on a special show I was doing. But since then, because for some reason I can't remember the damn name of the city, it's impossible to find. So I've been asking people, that's why. By the way, I like the cover of the book, too, by the way. But since you do this, hopefully you'll run across the story somewhere or you'll run across somebody else that run across it. I've heard it a couple other times on some other shows, but, you know, the last physical time I can remember hearing about it was about 10 years ago. So, you know, details are kind of fuzzy in my head, and I don't want to just go on about it, but I found it to be a fascinating story. I know somewhere in one of my old Wake Up USA episodes, I actually go into it in deep dive to go find it.
Okay, yeah.
It's just so much archive to go through to find.
Okay.
But if you ever hear about it, let me know, just pop me over an email, because, you know, there's other stories I've heard about with different types of shields, or there's several flying shields I've heard about. See, for me, anything prior to 300 years ago that's flying in the sky amazes me. Mm-hmm. Anytime I hear anything about a report of anything flying in the sky, because, you know, come on. The hot air balloon was the first time man really ever flew, and before that, there was nothing flying for literally 5,000 or 6,000 years. There was nothing in the sky. But all throughout recorded history, we have events of things flying around in the sky. So I find those stories particularly fascinating because, I mean, what is it? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, some of it you can write off as meteor showers or comets or other things, but some of this stuff, like what, two or three of the sightings over London, a couple of the ones over Rome, you can't. There's no way to really write them off other than for what the people saw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and back then when they saw stuff, they reported it as in group, as today, you know, somebody sees something, I didn't see that. What was that? I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
What is that? No, I don't know what that is. I have no idea what they were, but I do find it interesting that you have these reports prior to the modern era because there was no fight. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, Leonardo did draw some stuff, but as far as I knew, his glider never flew. And from what I've seen of it, I think it would have just crashed anyway. So, and that was still 500 years ago. So, you know, we can even go back 500, but anything after that, you got to kind of wonder, what are they talking about? What are they seeing in the sky? You know, what is these things that were hovering over cities for days on end? So, I don't know. It's one of the things that fascinates me. When I was looking at the cover, that's what made me think about it. When I was looking at the cover of the book, the one in the little triangle thing, the person sitting inside. That's always been. I found a lot of, I don't know how much of this you found, but a lot of the medieval artwork, or in that period, this 300 or 400 year period there, that a lot of the stuff like this seemed to show up. Pictures in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have a whole section on that in the book. And,
well, I'll be checking that out for sure.
Yeah, but the thing is, when you look into each individual example, usually you discover that they're illustrating a Bible story. But the fact that they have something in there that looks to us like a flying saucer, that does get your attention, but you've got to remember, we're taking our visual vocabulary and imposing it on people who had their own. Basically, a rather rich one, had nothing to do with ours. Like the example you see on the cover, or you have the Virgin Mary, and over her shoulder there's the Samus guy. It looks vaguely like maybe flying saucer. To me, it looks like a boat, actually. Maybe some golden rays coming out of it. Well, that's from a detail from a picture about the nativity. And of course, that's the Bible story, the birth of Jesus. And one of the parts of that story is that you have these shepherds in the field by night being confronted with the heavenly host. And if you look closely at the picture, you see that there's a guy down there below the land sky reacting to it, and around him are some sheep. So he's the shepherd, and he's reacting to the heavenly host as required by the Bible story. And of course, these things were fairly expensive projects commissioned by church officials, and the artist wanted to get satisfied with customers. So whatever they wanted was in there, and I'm sure there's nothing in there by accident. He doesn't slip something in there because he happens to see it in the sky. The other thing that you were talking about in the cover is a little more complicated. That's from a monastery in Kosovo. It's the inside of the dome, and it's a crucifixion scene that was painted in about 1350. And this doesn't say, this is the one picture I didn't think I would get, but it turns out, because it's an area of, you know, war-devastated Kosovo, just over the border from Albania in the middle of the mountains, that's 12 miles from the nearest town. Actually, I took only one phone call after I figured out who to call. So that was something else. But anyway. But when you look at it, you see that you have the Christ on the cross. And to one side, there is this thing appears to be moving toward Christ, and it's red, and it has a male face in it. And on the other side, there is a silver object moving away, and it has a female face. We see this is standard Byzantine iconography. And the red male is the sun, and the silver female is the moon. And they're moving like that to show that the lighting is changing, because the Gospels say it was dark from noon to 3 p.m. that day. And you have to have something to show that. And there are other outside scenes from other Bible stories in that dome, and none of them show anything like that in the sky. So basically, they're using standard here. And you'll see another Byzantine paintings too, something like that, with the red or male symbol and the silver or female or both symbol. Now, the thing about this, though, and the one in Kosovo, is that these objects in the sky look vaguely like Mercury capsules. And people first started pointing out that these things were calling UFOs in the 1960s, when, of course, the U.S. space program was in the news. So to me, it's sort of like the old joke about what we call locomotive lung, where you're breathing. It sounds like the gasping of a steam locomotive. And no one reported this condition, medical condition, before about 1830, or after about 1950, because that's, you know, they started using locomotives in 1830 and stopped in about 1950. So I think that's a similar thing here, basically. Maybe a good example of the reverse anachronism. I mean, it came into sync with the times during that period, but nowadays I think we have a sort of a more nuanced idea of what spacecraft are supposed to look like. But like I say, I get several examples, and when I talk about these things, I feel like I'm a children's party going around popping balloons, because, like I say, you can, in all cases here, find a fairly prosaic explanation of what the author was, the painter was doing. But on the other hand, you know, that doesn't mean I'm right either. I'm the first to admit that. But throughout the book, I try to use what's called Occam's razor, you know, the simplest explanation is the one to bet on. But the thing with the simplest explanation is not always correct.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah, so if you don't want to believe this, that's fine. But I really think my explanation is the simplest one. But if there were people out there in flying saucers flying around, that would actually be a simpler explanation, wouldn't it?
it would be the easiest one. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. If they're up there, you know, that's the easiest. But in the meantime, it strikes me as being sort of like, you know, Deus ex machina. You know, anything goes if we allow this. So, anyway, but my favorite, though, reverse anachronism would be concerns the one concerning Jules Verne, basically. He wrote during his lifetime about 50 novels. Not all of them were about science fiction, but he's best known for science fiction, that is. In these novels, he made a bunch of technological predictions. But most of them, most of these predictions can be seen as extensions of technology that existed in his lifetime. Air conditioners and fax machines and automobiles, and all that stuff could be inferred from stuff that existed then. But his first novel, written in 1865, described an American effort to send three men to the moon in an aluminum capsule. They launched from Florida, they circled the moon, they returned to Earth, they landed in the Pacific Ocean, and they're picked up by the U.S. Navy. Does that sound familiar in any way? It sounds like the Apollo program, doesn't it? And,
yeah,
of course, he shot him out of a cannon. He didn't use a rocket because that was the technology he could understand and his readers could accept at the time. But there are little wrinkles in there that just go beyond coincidence. Like, as part of the plot, he has Texas politicians making trouble because they want some involvement in the project. Well, in the actual Apollo program, that did happen, and that is why Mission Control is located in Houston. So there's just too many coincidences in the thing. I just, I cannot account for it. Like I say, and most of the other examples in the book, there are like 42 of them. I can point to something prosaic, but in this case, it's all out there. I mean, if you want to say that the guy was listening to some kind of echoes in the future and translating the 1865 technology, I would have to say, well, that's good explanations any. Because I don't know how it really got this idea. But there he is launching three men and a capsule from Florida. It's just bizarre when you think about it.
It is, because we discussed that part about stuff maybe being picked up in the future, in the past, and us trying to emulate it in one form or fashion or another.
Yeah.
So I don't rule out stuff like that, because, those kind of explanations do kind of lend credence to some of the stuff that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm sure half the people listening to us right now are going, time travel's impossible. Guys, for us it is. We're not even talking about time travel here. We're talking about echoes from the future into the past, something that's following along the line. We're not actually talking about anybody deliberately doing this. Even it could be possible they're doing that, but that's not what we're talking about.
Yeah,
that's a ripple, guys. It's like the guy standing in Sicily in 2000 BC or AD, and the guy standing in the same place in 4000 AD. We're talking 6,000 years difference here, but they're both standing in the same place at the same time. At the same point, so it is possible. I'm not going to rule stuff like that out, because you never know. Besides, that kind of stuff fascinates the hell out of me.
Again, the book is called Out of Place in Time and Space, in better bookstores. And just go in there and ask for it, Don't be shy. I think youth nowadays is hard to fight. And let's say, Out of Place in Time and Space. It does rhyme, and the author's name is Lamont Wood.
Guys, you can always pop to the website, click on the picture of the book, it takes you right to Amazon. Bam, bam, that simple.
Right.
Make it real easy for you.
Okay. And
that's easy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so we're trying to do that. One of my other favorite reverse anachronisms in the book, being a writer, would be the story about W.T. Stead. He was a Victorian journalist, started out in the 1880s, I guess. He was involved in the founding of the tabloid genre. Now, with the recent closing of the News of the World, we may be around for the end life of that genre to see it over with. But he was around when it started doing things like that. And he had ran sensationalist newspapers and did muckraking and pursued causes. And one of the causes he pursued involved his dislike of admiralty regulations that did not require ocean liners to carry enough lifeboats for all the passengers. And he, in fact, wrote evocative fiction about what was likely to happen in the case of a mid-ocean collision, as panic breaks out, as people realize there aren't enough lifeboats, et cetera, et cetera. And one of his stories even involved hitting an iceberg, in fact. And he got rich from his various efforts. He founded his own magazine at one point. And at one point he decided to go to the U.S. to attend a conference, and having made the big time, he bought first-class accommodations in the best available ship, which happened to be the brand new Titanic. And you have to wonder what he was thinking, especially as the water rose. And no, he didn't make it. He was one of the casualties. So I can't think of anything more ironic, really. He actually wrote about this problem, and then got on the Titanic and sailed away. Yes.
I don't know, but I got on a dance.
Yes. So, ladies and gentlemen, you need to worry about what you obsess over, because you might get maybe a little too involved in it at some point, it might be sucked into it totally like he was.
For you personally, when I'm looking at the cover, I'm thinking, there must be some favorites in here that you personally find favorite. I mean, things at a time and a place. And what was your favorites when you were researching this?
I told you about the one of Jules Verne. I think that's...
Yeah. Oh, I think that was great, too, by the way.
Yeah. There's a similar one concerning World War II. A British journalist named Hector Bywater wrote a book in, 1925. It was a novel that basically told the story of the title was The Great Pacific War, and describes a war between the U.S. and Japan in the Pacific in the 1930s. And it opens with a surprise attack by the Japanese, and the Japanese proceeded to overrun the Western Pacific, and then are slowly driven back in an island-hopping campaign. And the U.S. eventually gets in a position where they can bomb Japanese cities, and at that point, the Japanese cave in. Does any of that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds vaguely familiar. He has these actual detailed descriptions of various battles, I won't say they match what happened in the war, but he mentions actual ships, some of which do show up in the war. And that's one of the eerie parts about it. But, of course, both sides, they still had ships in the 20s that stroll around in the war, and they also recycled ship names. Beyond that, he sends the war just between Japan and the U.S., which it's not part of a world war. But other than that, if it's sort of a metaphor, it's eerie how close it gets. Now, the opening surprise attack is on the Panama Canal rather than Hawaii. That would actually make more sense, wouldn't it? If you could go to Panama Canal, and in the book they do for about 6 months, and lead to big problems. But as in the real war, the Americans managed to master forces and counterattack. Now, but he has the American admirals trying initially to just make one big counterattack, defeat the Japanese, and that does not work. And then they go on to the island hopping campaign. Now, I would point out, though, that a lot of American military men did read this book, and in the real war did not bother trying any kind of preemptive counterattack and just went straight to the island hopping. So I wonder if they, learned their lesson from the book. And, he describes various battles, but it's both 1925, and it's mostly gun battles. He does depict the use of airplanes, but it's mostly for artillery spotting. But he has, he mentions all those things, it takes the Japanese twice to take the island of Guam, and only one time, but they take the island of Wake on the first attempt. Now, in the real war, it's just the opposite. It took two attempts to take Wake, but only one to take Guam. And he describes an American attack on the Bonin Islands, a place called Chichijima. And in reality, they attacked Iwo Jima farther south. And this is sort of a theme throughout the book. He has the battles taking place over islands with Anchorage is one in real war usually happen on nearby islands where the air base was located. He mentions actual, place order or government point in the war, such as Truk Lagoon, the Palau Group, Palau, the Yap Islands. He has a decisive battle of the war in the Yap Islands. Actually, it was nearby in the Philippine Sea, the Battle of the Philippine Sea. So the way I say it, but the higher it gets, basically. Now, the question beyond that is, when you read this, the big question is, the guy named Yamamoto, I believe the book, the guy who was the head of the Japanese Navy at Pearl Harbor, I guess, for the opening part of the war. Mm-hmm. And did he get any idea? The answer is absolutely yes, he read it. Not only did he read it, he lectured about it at Japanese military academies and made a point of meeting with the author one time at a military conference. You wonder how much it affected his operations during the war. And you wonder if after, the opening attack worked, if he thought, here comes the rest of the book, what am I going to do now? And during that point, when the book says, you got the counterattack will be coming soon, he started going on a tour, an inspection tour of various Japanese bases in Southeast Pacific, and at one point was suddenly ambushed and shot down by long-range U.S. fighters. So we'll never know how he was affected by all this. I would point out that wasn't in the book. Americans pulled that one out on their own. But the probably the most mysterious thing in the book is not that. See, that guy, Hector Bywater, he was a professional naval and military journalist. He was very familiar with the navies on both sides and military technology. And he was writing the book basically to show that war in the Pacific would not be a walkover for either side. It'd be a very, very painful affair, which of course it was. And if he did was seeing the future, he left out a lot of things, such as raid arms, death marches, and stuff like that. Which
all the fun stuff, yeah.
Yes, or maybe he did see it because he died in a early in the war in a hotel room in London, and apparently drank himself to death. So, like I said, maybe he did see it. Maybe the medium is a message there. So, again, we'll never know. But that's not the most mysterious thing around across the book, as far as trying to explain something, or something being a reverse mechanism. To me, that's the Voynich manuscript. That is a hand-lettered, hand-illustrated book that showed up in about 1912. It's been dated to, I think, 1320, which is, of course, before the printing press was invented. Of course, it is hand-lettered, hand-illustrated. And it's written in an alphabetic language. And analysis shows that it follows rules of a language. And it fits into mathematical patterns, as you expect the language would, which indicates, incidentally, that that's not gibberish. It is actual language. Problem is, the alphabet is seen nowhere else. Seen only in this book. The rules of the language are not that of any known language. The mathematical pattern is not better than any known language. The illustrations in the book appear to be about something, but when you look at them, they're not about anything. Okay? What appears to be illustrations of botanical information, plants and stuff, but they don't match any known plants. And they appear to be illustrations of astronomical information, but they don't match anything known to astronomy. It has illustrations of weird plumbing and pictures of ladies standing around with their clothes on, but they're not doing it. All of which is hard to explain. Not only does the lettering appear to follow a rules of a language, but you see words used restricted to certain parts of the book, indicating apparently the part of the vocabulary
of the subject matter in that section. You don't hear anyplace else. In other words, it appears, it gives you the impression that it is a book written about something. But we can't prove that. No one has been able to figure out what. Some of the brightest lights in the field of photography have tried to decrypt it, assuming it's written, and have gotten nowhere. Now, it's been pointed out that you could achieve the same effect of having text that appears to fall in mathematical patterns, language patterns, by taking gibberish and then encrypting it. The act of encrypting it would give patterns that we see. And, you know, and that might be something worth doing if you wanted to, you know, impress the CIA. I don't think that was the issue in 1420. So, the other possibility is that we're dealing with, you know, somebody with what they call OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Some type of that will make up a language and will, you know, write a book based on that language. Usually, though, the analysis will show that it's the person's native language with some alterations. Usually you can figure it out. In this case, they haven't been able to do that. And then, again, there's the illustrations, which appear to be about something, but aren't really. You think, after a while, the illustrations would actually be about something, just because it's easier than just making up something that is not quite about something. But on the other hand, but whoever did this had access to tools and skill and material that were not widely available in 1420, and it probably took a year to do it. So the mystery just gets deeper and deeper. So this is one of my candidates for maybe a reverse anachronism in the future. Maybe we can't understand it because we have nothing in common with it. We have no way to approach it. Maybe in future centuries that will change, and we'll have some way to approach it. But at the moment, it's just a mystery.
You know, I'm listening because I always think about these kind of things and how people can pull off. And it's one thing about humans I got to give them credit for is that if you get something stuck in your craw, for lack of a better explanation, you can't seem to let it go. I mean, it's not, you know, whether it's today or 5,000 years ago or 5,000 years from now, there's something that changes about us anytime soon. It's just, it's not everybody, mind you, Lamont, but still, you know, a lot of people, myself included, if I get on something, I'm not letting it go until I get either what I want out of it or whatever I'm trying to achieve. That's enough to drive half my friends and family insane, but I can only imagine in cases like what we're talking about, it was probably the same way. I mean, it was probably driven nonstop, you know, something. It's also sometimes, I think, why there may have been some kind of link in the old world, because sometimes it's like someone downloaded something into somebody's head and the person was just like, holy blankety blank blank blank, and just took off in their life. Because I have seen some parallels, well, not parallels, but I've seen some points in history where a person's moving along, and all of a sudden they've had a stroke of genius out of the blue.
Right.
Like somebody hit him in the head or something. And normally we're talking, well, we'll make this easy and we'll use somebody more modern. There's a little guy, he's not too famous, he's figured out stuff, a couple of things, his name's Einstein. Out of the blue. We're talking about somebody who worked in a postal office, ladies and gentlemen, and who have wrote some of the most valuable formulas ever to exist in our history as a theoretical physicist. Speaking of that, well, I'm on that subject. E equals NC squared is coming under fire now because of that neutrino experiment. That's what I was going to say. Let's not hold our breath for any conclusive stuff anytime soon, but it's promising. It is promising. Not the first time we've tried something faster than light, but it's promising. So we'll see where it goes. By the way, the person who just sent me that means that we can travel. No, it does not mean that. It means one exotic particle managed to do this.
Yeah.
Maybe 10,000 years we might figure out how to do it with ourselves, but right now, no.
Well, this particle that goes faster than the speed of light, can it go slower than the speed of light? That's what I'm asking. You know, maybe it's not stuck, you know?
I actually sent in a question like that, could it go slower than speed of light? Because I remember the experiment done in the early 90s where they were measuring light bending around Jupiter. They found out when light approaches Jupiter, that it actually increases past light speed, but as it bends to the planet, it actually decreases. And get this, so that the light going around the planet and the energy passing through the planet meet on the other side at exactly the same time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you figure that one out. Eric's distance on the planet is like, okay, that doesn't work. So it proved right then and there that yeah, light can go faster than light speed. That was the first time we realized it. Now with this, we realize it. And again, it does suggest that somewhere in our far-flung future, we may be able to achieve, I'm not even saying that we'll ever be able to travel faster than light, but we may be able to do other things, like send particles to places, or energy to packets, or inanimate objects, maybe not us, but we may be able to send stuff far ahead of us when we're colonizing and things like that, which would be nice,
yeah,
on long colonization trips.
I have to go Stephen Hawking, who says, you know, if time travel were possible, where are the time travelers? You know,
Where are the time travelers?
The season's late, the rains are low, where are the tourists? You know, they should be showing up here. And
You broke up just a little bit there. But we're getting ready to go to break. We've got about a minute and a half before we go to break. So I got somebody coming on to plug the show. Why don't you go ahead and tell them one more time for the book, where they can find it at, just as we get ready to go to break.
Okay, again, the name is Out of Place in Time and Space. Yes, it does rhyme. Some people get off to that. The author, again, is Lamont Wood. It's by New Page Books, and you can find it on Amazon under the title of my name, Lamont Wood, or in better bookstores. My local Barnes & Noble's has it in the Paranormal New Age section, Paranormal Experience shelf.
It's actually, soon I get a chance, I'm going to read it. I wish they had it in the e-book form. Because I got so many books in my house, I'm not sure what to do with them. Hey, Jeffrey, hold on 1 second. While I'm thinking about it, I'm actually on the Fringology site at Blogspot, and they have a good article up about the Out of Place in Time and Space by Lamont Wood. It's a really good article. I got a vote down. Now, if you go there and check it out, and then go over to Amazon and purchase the book. Jeffrey! Y'all are Jeffrey from the Church of Neighbors, right? Jeffrey, what's up, man? How's the guy? What's up with that?
Hey, pretty much I just got off the phone with him, and he's going into surgery tomorrow to remove an abscess on his leg. Of course, he's been in the hospital because he injured his leg, and he has diabetes, so he had an infection. I forget the technical name of the infection. It's something pretty weird, but basically, he's been in there for about a week, and he injured tomorrow to help his leg out, so I'm basically asking everyone to prayer request for him, send out prayers for the old gooch, so he can get back to the show. He was planning on doing a show Saturday, but the surgery came up, so I'm not really sure if he's going to do the show Saturday or not. If he does it, I know Micah Hanks is going to stand in, hopefully. That's the plan, anyway.
No, that's good. That's good. Who are y'all going to have on this Saturday?
Timothy Wiley from Inner Traditions. He wrote a book called Return of the Rebel Angels. Pretty weird. It's basically he claims that the fallen angels have been forgiven by God, and they're returning to the earth. So I'm not quite sure how I feel about that. And they said that they've canceled Armageddon. So you know, it's going to be a pretty weird show. I'm not even sure how I feel about the whole Christian concept of Satan and God, so it should be pretty entertaining to say the least, for sure, Saturday night.
All we did last Saturday is going up through the roof, man. This is just blasting all over the place. We got like 7,000 downloads when I checked it yesterday. I don't know how many plays it's got, but I'm more interested in downloads. Damn plays are. You get a couple thousand plays, but. Downloads are always more important to me because that's the ones who are really down, you know, getting the archive. The player people are just the ones who go click and play on, which is probably less than 1% of our listening audience. But anyway, Jeff, I'm glad you came on. Plug show, guys. Be sure, Saturday night, 10 to midnight, Church of Mavis. Jeffrey's always a blast. Hopefully, Guy will be back soon because Guy's the only one who keeps Jeff in check. I had him flopping around last week a couple times. He's out of control, guys.
I had Jim on Saturday to keep me balanced, and hopefully Guy will be back Saturday. If not, Micah Hanks, or it could be Micah Hanks and Guy at the same time. We'll see how it goes. And I don't want to interview the fallen angel guy by myself. So I've told Mike and Guy one of them has to be there.
Somebody has to be there to hold my hand. But Jeff, thanks for coming on again, guys. We're going to get out of here and go to break. Remember, why don't you at the break go check that Out of Place in Time and Space by Lamont Wood. Check it out. See what you think. You can always go over to Amazon and purchase it. Like I said, you can go over to Fringology, check it out over there, get a kind of layout of the book as well. And, y'all, stay up. We'll be back in about 9 to 10 minutes. Everyone, please stay tuned.
You're listening to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Rumors spreading round in that Texas town about the shack outside the game. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you want to go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls out.
I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, hmm. My guest list is always up at www.gscott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
Hello, everyone. Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Fight with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George.
And I'm Stephanie Panetti. Psychic medium, are you sure about that, Chris? It's more like psychic and Lodge.
Yeah, real funny, Panetti. Depending on being my girlfriend, you would know. Together, we are Second Sight NYC, a parapsychic radio show based out of New York City.
Join us each week as we journey into the unknown. Let's cross the threshold of reality together.
We take a fun and no-nonsense approach to our show, and we love to interact with our audience. Each week, you can expect a great guest, interesting topics, and strong opinions by myself and Stephanie.
As well as rapid readings, psychic dream interpretations, and the gemstone of the week. And don't ask us a question that you don't want an answer to.
Give us 2 hours of your time to inform, enlighten, and entertain you. Let the journey begin.
Join us.
The Church of Mabus radio show is now in session, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern, with high strange scholars teaching us of ufology, the paranormal, the occult, and the metaphysical. Big Sanctuary with the Dark Reverends, Jeffrey Pritchard and Guy Widell at www.mabusincarnate.com, always moshing with the apocalypse. Now get down on your knees and pray!
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
I had had enough.
Well, you drove out there into the middle of nowhere and had some sort of loud verbal display challenging E.T. in general out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was doing. I had a pistol in my hand at the time. I was really ticked off. When I was having this fit, I was waving the gun in the air, okay, and I had this fit. And at this moment, I said, okay.
Was a Louisiana man named Montaldo. Folks around called him Six Gun Joe. Worked with ICAR, don't you know? Investigating UFOs. Out for a drive
with a gal one night. They stopped to check out the reporting site. When an alien lit right there on the ground, commenced to throw in his weight around. Now, old Sex Gun didn't take too kindly to that kind of thing. Unless we got Vaseline or anything, but, you know, seriously. Well, Six Gun looked that critter right in the eye and said, any last wish before you die, yo? Reach for his gun, quick as a twig, and said, fill your club, you son of a bitch. Now, a legend spread across the land about this pistol-waving man. But if you're from space or from Earth below, you don't give no lip to Six Gun Joe.
Welcome to UFO Undercover with your host, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to UFO Undercover. I hope everybody enjoyed the first hour of the show, guys and girls. I've been enjoying talking with Lamont. We've got a lot of interesting information. It's been a lot of interesting information through the first hour. So we're going to open up the phone lines and chat. I mean, I've already seen a couple of questions coming in via the different messenger systems and the Power Talk Virtual Auditorium and Facebook, which, where did Facebook go? There it is right there. But, you know, I know I told you at the beginning of the show, go over and check it out. Remember, go to the website, you can click right on the title of the book. Well, actually, you can just click picture of the book itself, it will take you straight over there. Guys, come on. Out of Place and Time and Space. Real easy title to remember. Des Ron, Lamont's right, Des Ron. You want to check it out, buy a copy, add it to your file. All right, get it for Christmas present, ladies and gentlemen. You know, it's getting to be that time of year, guys and girls. We're getting close to the holidays. You know, my favorite month of the year is coming up here real shortly. October is by far my favorite month, and they get in all kind of trouble. So I'm looking forward to that. And yes, we will be doing a special show next week on witchcraft, which should be interesting. In itself, those shows are always, they're always interested in Leah, that's for right now. Lamont, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Again, the book is called Out of Place in Time and Space. And as you mentioned, that Christmas gift, it is written to be read in airports, actually, or as a gift item. It's divided into chapters that are about the length of a magazine article, and each one stands alone. So you can start and stop reading as you please. And it's written to entertain and to intrigue. And I think most people will like it. Again, the title is Out of Place in Time and Space. And again, it's a collection of historical oddities that sort of leap out at you because they seem to fly in the face of a strictly linear conception of history. It looks at things that really shouldn't be there. People doing things well before they ought to be able to know how to do it. And I cover about 42 different examples in the book. Some of them are actually debunking examples. I find certain things actually is that they weren't really doing. Some cases I found it's like an urban legend. And in some cases I find fairly straightforward explanations. But in other places, I can't find an explanation, or the explanation strikes even me as kind of lame. Not sure where to go with it. But those of you who want to, blame it on time travelers, UFOs or something, go for it, that's what I say. But try to do some research and convince me, you know, because I've looked into this. Some of them I just can't figure out. Some I think I have figured out, but I may be fooling myself.
Well, that's part of the fun, part of the mystery, is trying to work them out. How they got there, how did someone think about this, right. Why did this happen in this time, you know, this time period, or what it is. Now, you know, while I'm thinking about this, because I haven't had a chance to read the book, so I want to ask a couple other questions. Now, I had seen somebody write in, matter of fact, from Sydney a few minutes ago, Janet had written in, and she wanted to know if you had found any stuff from any of the Egyptian period that was mentioned in the book.
There's a couple of things that leap out. Yeah, there's the so-called Sakura bird, Sakura, S-A-Q-Q-A-R-A, named after a cemetery, and it found a tomb from about 200 B.C., and it looks like a toy model airplane. And again, I was in the first half, I was talking about this theme that I keep running across, is that you find things in toys that and culture that you don't find in the rest of the culture. That painting from 1460 that shows up flying to a helicopter, or the steam-powered toys that the Greeks and Romans had. Well, is this a toy airplane? That would be kind of odd, because we're pretty sure the Egyptians did not have real airplanes, or even gliders. I think we'd know about it if they did. It would give them distinct military advantages that they would no doubt advertise, since scaring people is a lot easier than fighting them, frankly. So you want them to think you have more than you do. The thing, I don't know, basically. Looking at it, it's not a convincing bird model. It's not a really convincing airplane model. It has a horizontal, it has a rudder, a horizontal stabilizer. Now, if it was a bird, there would be a flat tail. But it has a vertical tail, like an airplane, but there's no horizontal rudder either. So it, as a toy airplane, it wouldn't really fly. Now, of course, a lot of toys aren't supposed to be all that realistic because they're made to be dragged through sandboxes, etc. But this thing, in front of it, you know, there's a beak and some eyes, as if it were supposed to be representing a bird, but the rest of it, actually, it doesn't really look like a bird. My theory is it's really neither. It's a weather vane. But why they put it in the tomb, I can't imagine. So, again, this is one of those things where I have an explanation, which I think fits Occam's razor, which is supposed to be the simplest explanation. But I could be convinced otherwise. You know, I see it, I have an explanation, but if you want to believe something else, go for it, basically. I can't.
Yeah, because when we get into this kind of stuff, there's so much speculation going on here. And, you know, we can look at something, you know, it's like Georgia Tukuyov with that little winged plane thing he always wears on his lapel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at that. Yeah, that could be a great little glider. Now, mm-hmm. The argument here is this a model of something that was working, or was this something the Aztecs or the Mayans just developed a little glider by watching a bird for their kids? Mm-hmm. See, there's no real way of knowing this. I mean, they say all the designs and the wings were propellers. Well, you don't know that. They could just be circles that they put in.
Right.
Far as we know, these were just, you know, people were emulating birds, because it wouldn't be the first time in our history that someone made a model of a bird and tried to fly it. I mean, this has happened throughout the last 10,000 years. So I don't, you know, when it comes to stuff like that, I don't want to just instantly, oh, well, it's an extraterrestrial craft or it's some kind of advanced technology or what have you, because it may have simply been what it was. Might have been. Somebody made a model, and somebody made a little picture of the model, or, you know, it was a little behind with something of the model drawing. So I don't want to take it for more than what it is. I mean, I do, like I said earlier, though, I find all of this stuff extremely fascinating, because anytime you mention flying in the sky prior to, 300 or 400 years ago, you just got to stop and wonder. But still, I keep seeing Mark just wrote in from Saskatchewan, Canada. Did I pronounce that right? He had wrote in saying basically what he said was is, how do we know that everything in the past isn't extraterrestrial? Well,
how do we know it was, you know?
I know, I mean, that's the point. I mean, guys, because y'all know I'm studying this all the time, I'm a big, big freak on archaeology. I mean, it's one of my pet peeves, that and physics are probably two of my biggest pet peeves. I can't get enough of it. It's just, unfortunately, I just can't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I would like to say that this means that, or this means this, or this means that, unless I can travel back and find some ancient text somewhere that said, you know, E.T. landed and visited and did this, that, or the other thing, before then, I'm speculating. And that's what we're doing here. And there are, and there can be other plausible explanations for this stuff. And you're not as a researcher, you're not worth your salt if you can't admit when you're wrong, or you can't look at alternative explanations without being offended.
You know, you always have to have some level of faith someplace. I mean, I assume you're Joe Montaldo and not some lizard-lipped alien who's just on the airways here trying to take over planet Earth. You assume I'm Lamont Wood, author of Out of Place in Time and Space, and not some silver-toned orator the publisher hired to impersonate me, although that's sounds interesting. But, so, you know, at some level, you have some bedrock to go on. And my the one I use, of course, is Occam's Razor. Simplest explanation is the best. The simplest explanation is that history is real. You know, humanity does exist and has for a while. Now, but going back to the Egyptian thing, I also have a second chapter on Egyptian history, the Sphinx. You know, the Sphinx is, but as it turns out, I discovered, it may not even be Egyptian. They don't know who built it, when, or why. It may predate the pharaohs, as a matter of fact. We don't really know. You would think we would know something about it, very little about it, but it's sitting there. The problem with it is that it's surrounded by these relics, and remains, and tombs and stuff that we can we can date with considerable confidence because the guy's name is on it normally. And we have a pretty good dating back to the historical part of the, you know, ancient Egypt. And, it's up there on the edge of the Giza Plateau where the Great Pyramids are and all the funeral temples around it. And, the rainfall there averages about 1 inch a year. And on the remains that that we can date, we can still see chisel marks and stuff like that. And the stuff is shoehorned around the Sphinx as if it was built afterwards and the thing was in the way. And the Sphinx itself, you can find obvious marks of water erosion, which is pretty weird because, like, there are things beside it that show no water erosion, right next door. Which leads some people to believe that maybe it goes back to like the last ice age, and it's like, well, there was severe rainfall there, which pushes it back like 7 or 10,000 years. In which case, who did build it and why? And again, that's no mystery. There's some more mystery to know. And there's some people who take middle ground and say, well, at some point during all this construction, they must have also blamed all the runoff ran through the Sphinx. Because it didn't always look like it does now. For most of its history is buried at least up to its head. And when they first excavated during the Paleolithic era, they found a carved monument between its legs from someone who ordered this excavation about 1300 BC, I think it was. And there are really no other monuments that mention it or any other hieroglyphic references to it that we found in ancient Greek, in ancient Egypt. So apparently it was considered ancient even by then, but maybe by the pharaohs. So also we associate it with ancient Egypt, but it may predate the pharaohs. As it turns out, we don't know. It's a mystery. Again, something out of place in time and space. Something to look at carefully, and what you think you knew just kind of evaporates.
I got a gentleman writing in from Israel, Alon. I know I'm pronouncing his name wrong, but it looks like Aaron, but that's not how it's spelled.
Okay.
Anyway, he's writing in, and first thing he asks, is there anything in the ancient world, anything is around the Temple Mount or anything like that that might fall into what we're talking about in your book? And he also asked, could all of these inventions all just be God's will? Well, anything is possible.
Oh, okay. I have not run across anything you're talking about from, like, in Israel and the Temple Mount, stuff like that. No, I haven't. There's nothing like that in the book. I haven't run anything from there that particularly leaked out of that.
Great to know.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Try it again, because you're breaking up just a little bit. I don't know what's...
Okay.
Man, 1 minute you're clear, 1 minute you're breaking, it's making me crazy.
Okay. Okay.
Any electric connection, I don't know, like I said, it might be the weather between us.
Okay.
Every night, the sky gets a little weird, too, but go ahead, I'll let you finish.
Okay, no, I haven't read, there's nothing in the book from the Middle East or Holy Land. And as far as everything being God's will, well, honestly, let's see, how could it pose God's will, you know? I'm a little worried about the whole, what I call the Deus Ex Machina thing, to say that it happened because powerful forces came down and make it happen. Well, you know, that could always be the case, but I try to look for something a little more simpler, basically, that requires fewer assumptions. And again, it goes along with Hawkins' reason. In most cases, I can identify something, but admittedly, not in all cases. And in some of the cases where I do, you might think it's a little lame sometimes, but, you know, that's your privilege. Next question.
There you go. That was kind of... That's why I just referred to you. I've got to be careful with those kind of questions. They're getting me in a lot of trouble. Wait, our last one go. What did I just do? Oh, yeah. Candace writes in from Oregon wanting to know, have you seen anything while researching the book that would make you think that this could be extraterrestrial or could be something else? Or and they want an example of if it is something else, what do you think it is? Now, I know we talked about this earlier, but I'm going to get Lamont to go back over it. Go ahead, Lamont.
Okay, of course it could be extraterrestrial, but frankly, and that might be the simplest explanation, if there are extraterrestrials out there doing things, and if there are UFOs, I'm not convinced that there are, or if there are, that we know anything about them, that we can identify them and their artifacts, or actions with any certainty, that we can separate that from natural phenomena. You follow me so far?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm a little leery of such explanations, because you could say anything. It's, again, we're talking about Deus Ex Machina. Anything goes if you want to do that. So again, I'm trying to stick to going back to Occam's razor. And so I have found nothing that has, you know, shaken my faith and made me decide that, you know, human history is a product of extraterrestrials. What I have come to suspect is that it may be that we don't understand, like I'm certain, we don't really understand time, and it deserves more study than it's giving. We take it on faith that it exists, and I think that faith is unwarranted. I think it may be very possible that the passage of time is an illusion created by our perceptual framework or our perceptual mechanism, which requires that we perceive things in serial order, one thing at a time. And presumably there's some judgment involved about what we do perceive and don't. And somehow we think this with each other, et cetera, et cetera. If passage of time is an illusion, presumably space and three-dimensional objects are also, but I can't really prove that. But anyway. That piece of information, I realize, is not very useful. It implies that we're part of the machine, and we can't really step outside it and examine the machine and understand its workings. And that's not really as upbeat as I would like to be, I guess. But I'm saying that maybe we should pay more attention to this phenomenon, and then maybe we could, like, define the sort of outline of this thing. If we can't get outside and look at it, at least we can understand where we are in it. But maybe we're like fish who can't understand what water is.
Yeah, yeah. Whoops. I was reading a question while you were answering that question.
Oh, okay.
I just thought, well, I try to keep them in my head while we're going, because I don't want to look at what we have questions coming in. Now, Bob Osh writes in, Bob, where are you from? New York City. Well, how you doing there in New York? I'm getting hurricanes this year and stuff. And now you know because I have a 7 is feeling now. Now, yeah, I got a real hurricane. I ain't got nothing to worry about. What's this question here? Where did it go? Oh, no, I lost the question. Oh, there it is. Bob basically wants to know, what possessed you to take this subject line? Now, we know you're a writer. We know you write different stuff. Oh, and he also wanted to know what other, if you have any other books to credit, if you could please mention them.
Not about history topics like this.
He just meant in general any other books. Because he said he found you fascinating. He was just curious to what other books
I'm glad. And, I spend most of my time writing nonfiction stuff for computer and industrial magazines, which, of course, involves server research, and you have to keep on top of things. So I transferred that to history, basically, mostly history buff. And the same approach does seem to work. Take nothing for granted and try to investigate everything from multiple angles. So I got into this basically because I am a history buff, and I kept noticing things that if you look at it a little differently, suddenly it flies in the face of a strictly linear conception of time or history. Simple little things like, for instance, I have to read a book about Admiral Nelson at the Battle of Trafalgar, which seems rather prosaic, but he wrote a memo for his captains just before the battle explaining how he wanted the battle fought. And he diagrammed it in terms of, I want to send X number of ships against X number of enemy ships in this part of the enemy line, and this part of the enemy line, and this part of the enemy line. And it all seemed to be based on mathematical ratios, which is all very nice. And he went on and won the battle. Now, the battle was in, I think, 1805, 1916, 111 years later. Someone sat down and formulated what we call the N-squared law of mutual attrition, and then applied it to this memo he wrote. It fits perfectly. So it appeared to be based on a mathematical formula published 111 years after the battle and after his death. He doesn't mention anything like that in his memo or in his writings. His captains don't mention anything about this in their memoirs. But it follows the law exactly. It's as if he knew it. Again, something that flies in the face of a strictly linear conception of history. Usually, at least modern history, has been discoveries amount to letting the genie out of the bottle. Now that we know how steam locomotion works, it probably won't go away. We'll never lose that basic knowledge. Now that we know how gunpowder works, et cetera, electricity. Once it's out of the bottle, it seems to be around to stay. And I think if this had actually been discovered in his lifetime, it would have been out of the bottle. But it wasn't. So where did he... Again, something that flies in the face of a strictly linear conception of history. And, of course, earlier I was talking about Jules Verne and his first novel, which appears to be a sort of an outline, a description of the Apollo program. With all these details that just go well beyond any coincidence. Have I convinced you so far? What was the question?
Oh, actually, we got other ones just coming in.
Okay.
While we're talking, I was listening to you talking and reading these at the same time and watching the virtual auditorium as well. You know, we keep an auditorium, a chat room on Pod Talk. Which right now I think it's about 30 people in. And they just hang out, and I use it for two things. One, if we want to take questions, we can take questions directly out of the room, which is great. But I also use it to keep tabs of the interviews. Because, if I'm listening to guests and I'm watching a text go by and they're talking about eating or their puppies or other things, then we know we've lost the audience and it's time to swing it around. It's always a great way to judge an interview. Because you just never know, what a listening audience is going to be into. You just don't. We're talking to a lot of people here, and they could be into any damn thing, which I find interesting. Anyway, now let me switch over to this. We've been taking questions from that. Well, let's go be fair and take questions from over here. Guys, if you've been calling, I have not been watching Skype line, so I apologize for that. I've been actually reading because we got a bunch of emails coming in. So I've been kind of reading through the different email lists, not from the URN list right now. Now, this is Don writing, and Don, where are you from? Don is from Ohio. Well, hello up there in Ohio. How you doing up there? He wanted to know, basically, let me scroll down. I'm sure I got this whole question right in my head. Okay. He wanted to know if you, while you were looking through all of this, while you were writing the book, Did you see anything that may have, like in Mesoamerica, in Native Americans, anything from like America, say, you know, 500,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago? Actually, he's got 500, 1,500, and 2,000 years written, so I'm assuming he's talking about the last 2,000 years on the American continent. Anything substantial was mentioned in the book there?
Yeah.
That was interesting, by the way, here, Don.
I do have a section on the Kennewick Man. That was the skeleton that was found in Kennewick, Washington, in whenever it was. If I find the chapter here, I can tell you. In the 90s, I think it was found on the again in Kennewick, Washington. They assumed it was some forgotten pioneer. One, it was had Caucasian features, and two, there was an arrowhead stuck in the guy's thigh. And except when they examined it closer, they realized this was a stone arrowhead of the type that hadn't been used for thousands of years. So they did carbon dating on the bones, discovered they're about 8,000 years old. Now, to be 8,000 years old and have Caucasian features and being Kennewick, Washington, that's kind of mutually exclusive things. How did they Caucasians didn't show up with your DNA until, you know, 1492. So how'd this guy get there? If he showed up in Europe, you know, he crossed the mountain ranges. Further analysis showed that he may not be Caucasian, but what they call Caucasoid. He looked vaguely Caucasian, but could be from the Ainu people of the Aboriginal people of northern Japan, which is interesting, but northern Japan is no closer than Europe when you're in Kennewick, Washington. We still don't know how the guy got there. But on the other hand, they find very few skeletons that old in the Western Hemisphere. And the ones they have, just a couple others that I know of, one had Polynesian DNA, and one had African DNA. So people apparently were, well, either there were people really getting around back then, or what we take of stereotypes now didn't really fit then. There's been so much, slow mixture between now. We really can't say that, you know, this person was from there. Maybe they passed through at some point. I think it just goes to show that we really don't know as much as we'd like to know about prehistory in North America. I mean, it's still an open book, a closed book.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, cause, you know, anytime I think about this particular continent, because lately we've been working on a blood type study for alien abductions and things along these lines, and while we're doing this blood type study, because we've been asking anybody who said they've seen an alien or had contact if they would submit their eye colors and blood types, kind of curiosity to see where it leads, and there has been some interesting finds in that. But more importantly, you know, in the old days we all came out of Africa, right? That's where we came from, and we migrated up and across the land bridge and down to South America. Well, I'm working with three doctors in this blood type study, so I asked them a question one day. I said, if that's true, then why is everyone in South America and Central America 99.9% O? If we had actually migrated over, then we'd be A or AB or AB, because that was the dominant blood types in Africa and Europe, not O. Mm-hmm. O is extremely dominant in the Americas, but not so much. I mean, it's over there. It's 20 and 30% like it is there. But here, in these two, I mean, you're talking Central and South America, 99% O. And in North America, it's 50%.
Right.
And what it looks like is that it started from South America, moved into Central America. You can even see where it moved into the central country. It moved up to the upper West Coast and then on Alaska. They might have went the other way.
Right.
So what I'm actually thinking is we started on both sides of the ocean and met somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing that makes any reasonable sense. And I talked to a DNA specialist about that, a geneticist about this. And I asked him point blank, what would it take to create a healthy population of 6 billion? He said you'd have to have a minimum starting population of 6,000. He said there ain't no way there was a minimum starting population of 6,000 on the Africa savanna back a million years ago. They would have never survived. There would have been too many of them. There wouldn't have been enough food. They would have been too vulnerable to predators. It just wouldn't have happened. He said, but you could have had a smaller population that started there, and a smaller population started in America, then eventually met and interbred, and those two blood types got together and created the population that's here today. That actually makes sense to me. And now these three doctors are writing a thesis on it, which would be interesting because I have an honorable mention in it for bringing it up. But these are the kind of stuff while you're doing research that you run across. And nobody ever thought to ask these guys why. You know, all these big-name scientists, all these genetic experts, and no one ever asked the question why that South America and Central America are 99% O. If we came from Africa, no one even ran. That's what the doctor said, and he thought it was funny when I talked to him about it. He said only because no one's ever really asked this question before. He said we assumed that the theory out of Africa was correct and moved on.
Right.
And he said, but that's going to change. So that's interesting. So, you know, you stumble across things like that, and let's see. Dan Aykroyd, oh, that's somebody writing about Dan Aykroyd. Sorry about that. Does Dan Aykroyd believe in aliens? Ask Dan. I have no idea. Actually, I do, but ask him anyway. Let's move over to this email over here. Now, this is Janice. Janice, where are you writing in from, Janice? Oh, from the UK. Well, welcome. I know it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. Janice said you've been in fascinating interview so far. Thank you for coming on the show. She also wanted to know, do you get any special meaning out of any of this that we've been talking about tonight as far as your book goes itself? Does anything have, any of this have a special meaning for you is what the question actually says.
I don't know what would be more special than anything else. Special meaning. Again,
I think the sense that I'm getting is she meant the whole book itself. Does the information in the whole book itself have a special meaning or a special place in, I guess, your heart or in your life?
As I was saying earlier, it seems to point out that we don't understand time, and that may be because there is no such thing as time. Frankly, we can't isolate it in the lab, you know. It may be the passage of time is an illusion. If that's special, it's big, that's for sure. And I think that would be the big picture, the special thing that would come out of this. And the fact that we need to pay more attention to this. I think now that humanity is moving into a new era where everything is better documented and computerized, we may find more and more of these what I call reverse anachronisms. And we'll be in a better position to understand or at least study the phenomena of time. Because we can find these outliers that don't really fit our conception of it. And from that, we may be able to learn something. Of course, it's always from the extreme cases and the outliers that you're able to find the big picture.
All of this is just beyond fascinating to me. I could sit here and discuss all the weird stuff in the past I find it interesting. Now, I think we might have enough time for one more question here. We got about 9 minutes, I think. Yeah, let's squeeze in one more. Who is this? Ah, this is Bill from New Zealand. Hey, Bill, New Zealand. Do you know Suzanne Hansen? She's a friend of mine down there, runs a big organization. And Bob, tell her hi if you do know. Let's see. Let's go back to the question here. It says, Lamont, I find everything you say interesting, but how do you know it's not just natural progression?
Well, some of it is, I'm fairly sure, but some of it just cannot be explained that way. Like I was talking about the Voynich manuscripts. That's obviously man-made. I mean, there's natural progression there, and the Kenouk man does not match any local tribes. He's from some either northern Japan or Europe, and those are long ways away for someone who's 9,000 years old. We had ocean-going ships, presumably. So you have to, analyze things, and again, look for the simplest explanation, which sometimes works, and sometimes you just realize we don't have enough data to go on. Basically, you have to accept that.
Yeah. No, he's not related to Lamont, Alfred, whatever, guys. Come on, it's two totally different names. Sorry. cool.
I'm sure he's a nice person.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, you know. He was Secretary of Science for Jimmy Carter, who they're talking about.
Okay,
right. And he's a close and dear friend of mine. No, they're not. They just got the same first name, guys. That's it already. I love stuff like that. It always cracks me up.
Oh, well, now this one came in. This comes in from Chris from Chicago. He wanted to know any new books up and coming in the near future. Give him a chance to get this one. So
yeah, really.
Go ahead.
This one, come on, guys. I have some in the planning stage, but nothing I can talk about, and that sounds silly, frankly. I do assume I'll come out with a sequel to this, because there are more examples out there. The more I look for these things, the more I find them.
Mm-hmm. Now, Angela just wrote in from St. Louis and wanted to know if you believed in God. I think he said that, but I'll go ahead and let you tell him again. And I have no idea what that has to do with what we're talking about right now.
Well, I don't. Does God believe in me? I think would be a better question.
That's a good question.
And I think maybe we should all ask that one. Yeah, I assume that there's a supreme being and creator, but sort of an intelligence that is more than the sum of the universe, the parts of the universe. Let's put it that way.
Questions like that, guys. I do understand why you ask those questions, but really, what we're talking about now is not really pertaining to what we're doing. I mean, we can blame everything on God. You know, I ask people this every day. How come when something bad happens, we blame it on God and not the other guy? I never did understand that. I hear people all the time, well, God did it. Why? How do you know Satan did that? Do you believe in this kind of stuff? How do you? You know, I always wondered about that one. It's one of them questions you have to kind of go. Now, remember, ladies and gentlemen, you can go over to the UFO on the cover site, click on the site, click on Lamont, you can click on his face, you can click on the book title itself, and I'll take you right over to Amazon. You can purchase the book that way. Go out and check it out. I'm going to get a copy because I just want to see all the different stuff. And for me, these are like references. For me. I even record like the ancient astronauts and stuff like that, the ones that I find pertinent with information like this, or even specials I see on this kind of stuff, because I use them in shows and research are doing things along those lines because they help guide me and look at it. Also, shortcuts. It takes out some of the research if someone else does the work. I hate to say it that way, but it's true. People pray for miracles. I understand that. And they get them sometimes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That God did it. That's true. Yeah. That's like saying E.T. did it when you say that. I mean, come on. There's no way to prove it. Now, when we die, you know, either we'll find them or we won't. And then I guess then we'll know. But I'm not in any hurry to find out, so we'll wait on that one. So, Mike, I got to say, you've been great having you on tonight, man. We got about 3 or 4 minutes left. any particular, if you were going to sell this book, you know, and you're looking at the book, and there was any one particular thing that you would say would be the reason to buy the book, what would it be?
Well, we didn't talk about the last two chapters where I talk about the...
Go ahead. We got time. Go ahead.
Okay. Deimos and Phobos. The thing about them is that they were described about 150 years before they were discovered. You remember Gulliver's Travels? You may have read part of it in school. Well, there's a mention in there of the astronomers of one of these islands that Gulliver ends up on having discovered two moons of Mars, and he describes them in terms of their distance from Mars in terms of planetary diameters and their orbital period around Mars in terms of hours, because they're fairly close, so it's a matter of hours then and days. Now, 150 years later, someone buying two moons around Mars, and the distance from Mars was a few planetary diameters, as mentioned in the book, and the orbital period was a matter of hours. Now, that's kind of weird, because he had nothing to go on when he described those moons. I did the math, and if you take the moons he describes and plop them into the Martian gravity, it doesn't work. I mean, the description was pulled out of the air, not based on his real knowledge of Mars and its moons. So apparently he was just trying to come up with something that showed that the astronomers of this made-up world had found proof for Kepler's laws of planetary motion, basically. Because if you do the math on his invented moons, it does uphold the Kepler's laws. Okay, so far so good. But then we have sent probes to those moons, and on Phobos, the inner one, we find, well, there's several things about it, in the case of both moons, the orbits around Mars are near circular, and they match almost exactly, the orbital plane is almost exactly that of the Martian equator. And that's pretty weird, because they're obviously captured. They weren't, they didn't congeal out of the same cloud as Mars did, as is the case with the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, et cetera, et cetera. The terrestrial planets apparently don't get moons that way. They get them either from capturing asteroids or from some big big impact, which had created Earth's moon. So with orbital characteristics like that, if they're not artificial satellites, they ought to be. Because to be captured, something has to fall toward the planet, miss the planet, and then whip around it. But as it falls toward the planet, it will pick up a velocity in relation to the planet that's about equal to the planet's escape velocity. So if it doesn't hit the planet, it'll whip around and escape, unless something has slowed it down. Now, with the outer planets, you usually have a retinue of moons that could use their gravity to come in, and it ends up being captured. But with Mars, you only have Deimos and Phobos. They're tiny. I don't think they captured themselves or each other. So again, if they're not artificial, they ought to be. Of course, you'd think they're, you know, they'd have to be made of sheet metal, and the photos show that they're like big charcoal briquettes. I mean, they're not made out of sheet metal. Although one analysis shows that Phobos is probably about 30% hollow. That doesn't mean there are people living inside it or something, but it means it's just not factory type. But, you know, if they have moons like that, fairly low orbit, right on the equator, made out of material that you could mine minerals from to get oxygen out of for rocket fuel, would be very handy if you're involved in some kind of planetary navigation. So maybe someone put them there for that reason. You could take asteroids and slowly maneuver them into orbit around Mars and have these what I call way stations where you would mine fuel and store it for your rockets going back and forth. So who did that? Well, we didn't, pretty sure. So I have to throw that one out. Now, I come up with an explanation that purely for entertainment purposes. And I don't want to sound like I'm doing the E.T. thing. But I'm coming out. I'm going to say, do we have time for this? Or?
Yeah, go ahead. We're getting there. Go ahead.
Okay, so I point out that the dinosaurs were wiped out by an impact, that Chicxulub was saying, by an object that's about the size of Phobos. So maybe somebody tried it here on Earth and they slipped up. Now, among the dinosaurs that was wiped out when this thing impacted was a species called Strathelominus, who stood upright and had grasping forelimbs and stereoscopic vision. Right? And that's us. We stand upright with grasping forelimbs. Stereoscopic vision. If some of them had achieved some extra, you know, brain capacity, as we have demonstrated in our history, achieving technological mastery only takes a few centuries, you know, when things get rolling. Maybe they did that and ended up, you know, plastering themselves. I don't really know, but a recent space probe has taken a picture from Phobos that appears to show something on the surface of it that to me looks like a top of a silo sticking out of the dust. Now, it could be a very large, very symmetrical boulder, which would be odd, or it could be, who knows, some kind of leftover equipment. Now, the ground around it, if you can get the original NASA photo, shows the usual little craters, but they're also like reverse craters, little bumps in the ground, as if the dust is covering something else in there. So, at this point, I'm getting to believe that, you know, space exploration is not a luxury. It's something we really need to pursue for its own sake, because we live in the same solar system, and I think we need to understand what's going on. Okay?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I got
that.
That was a good wrap. Guys and girls, we're out of time. We actually went over a minute or two there. I actually had some comments on there, but now I know we're short on time. I'm not going to be able to say them.
Lamont, you're a great guest. I had a great time. I mean, I have to get you back in the future just so we can... Well, I'm going to get the books. I can actually go through it. We'll come back.
Okay.
And well, that'll make it easier on me, too. But anyway, I want to tell you, you did a great job tonight. You were fantastic. I look forward to talking to you again in the future. Any parting words before we get out of here?
Again, the title is Out of Place in Time and Space.
And guys, it will be available on UFO on the Cover site until next Monday. I think we leave it up Monday. It's actually Tuesday. We don't switch guests until Tuesday, so you can catch it anytime. You can go right over UFO on the Cover, click on the picture of the book, it'll take you right to the Amazon site. There you go. Easy peasy. Can't ask any more than again. Lamont, thanks for being on. I had a great time, man.
Okay. I appreciate it.
Good night.
Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, Second Sight will be joining us here in just 1 minute to come on and discuss who their guest is going to be this week. I hope you have a good time talking to Lamont. Y'all know this is one of my favorite topics. Anything dealing with ancient world, especially stuff that are out of place, I just always fascinates me. Stephanie, what's up?
Hi, Joe.
What's going on, Joe? Hey, Chris, what's up, man? What y'all doing, guys?
You sound surprised that I'm here. I'm always with Stephanie.
Oh, yeah, sure. I believe her. I'm easy, man. I believe all these stuff.
Sure.
How y'all doing, man? I believe everything. You can tell me yes, you got pretty land in the swamp for sale. I buy it. Like, that's how you get
well, we have the Verrazano Bridge for sale here.
I ain't buying a bridge stuff. Bridges worry me. The invisible ones especially, or the ones that are falling down, really worry me even more. So guys, what y'all up to?
Well, tomorrow night we got a really cool show. We have a tarot expert, Scotty Robertson. First time we've ever had a tarot guy on the show.
He's going to give some readings. We're going to have some callers, I guess, on the second hour, and he's going to give a couple readings out to...
Yeah, they're three-part readings. It should be interesting. We've never done it on the show before, so we want our listeners to call in to get a nice free three-card reading. And, of course, tomorrow we have the new segment, The Church of Second Sight, which is basically we take topic. Usually one of our listeners give us a topic, and we take it and we run with it. We tell you what we think about it as real as we can, and we hold nothing back. And, Stephanie, can I get an amen?
Oh, Lord. You see what I have to deal with?
So tomorrow's topic is wannabes, people who want to be like me. And I'm going to give it to them.
You want
to
be like you.
Yeah, why not?
Well, guys, you better write down the number, because 504-273-7373 time. You know, the last three times we did tarot readings on a network, it was standing room only. So,
really?
Maybe
we have to do the whole second hour call, and you never know. We'll take as many calls as we can.
This guy has extensive experience with tarot from historic levels to, he's really knowledgeable, so we're looking forward to this guest. It's going to be a good night.
You know, that's a good idea. I might have to do that next Wednesday, do some tarot reading, because we're going to be doing a witch show. I might break out the old cat card. Crowley's cards are scary enough, but I got these cat cards. These things are basically just evil. I used to do three decks. I used to do the good medium deck and the bad deck, because it always gave everybody one end or the other, and so you could find a happy medium yourself.
Right.
The cat cards are always will tell you the bad stuff that's going to happen to you every time.
That sounds like it's fun, though, with the cat cards.
Yeah. We might break them out. We'll see. But, guys, y'all be sure to check out Second Sight tomorrow night. Come over and check it out. Second Light NYC, 8 to 10 Central Time, right?
Eastern time.
7 to 9 Central Time, 8 to 10 Eastern Time. Oh, I'm giving y'all a long time. That's never good. Guys, thanks. Come on. Any parting words before we get out of here?
I think
we just want everybody listening. We're looking forward to having a great show, and thanks for having us on to plug it.
We'll see you folks tomorrow.
All right, guys. See y'all tomorrow night. Good night, everybody.
And I am delighted that you are here. We're here because you have a right to know. We're